This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Hello, my name is Kate Payne, and you're listening to This Australian Life on Joy 94.9. This Australian Life is a show for LGBTIQ voices and their stories. Thanks for listening. Today in the first half of our show, we're talking with Elle, whose name has been changed for purposes of anonymity. Elle is a 21-year-old cis female living in Melbourne who has struggled since the age of 14 with issues of addiction, eating disorders, and self-harm. Despite these trials, Elle is here with us today, sober and healthy, to share about her journey through countless psych wards, a rehab, and finally recovery. In the second half, we'll hear from Elle's father and his experience watching and witnessing his daughter's struggle. We hope you enjoy.
I guess the first major illness I developed was anorexia, and I was about 14, maybe 13, when the symptoms started to come on, and when I was 15, I had to be taken out of school a lot to be hospitalised and get treatment for that. And then during treatment, I developed this really awful kind of depression, and I started to deal with that through using drugs and alcohol. And then that kind of became as much of a problem as the eating disorder was.
So when you talk about going into these, like getting treatment for this, like what was that situation like?
So when I was younger, I was in like pediatric medical wards. And in that situation, there were, I think there were 6 disordered beds on that children's ward. There are other kids on heart monitors, and they just, you know, starve themselves so badly that they were just like, we're all just like so depleted and ill. And so I was in there maybe 6 times for quite long stays. And then I ended up, after I was just discharged from there, I didn't know how to function, you know, going back to school and just functioning in the world anymore. So I kind of, I ended up just like trying to commit suicide when I was 15, I think, and I ended up in an adolescent psych ward, which now that I think about it is a really confronting place.
So you talk about the eating disorder, or the, it was like a pediatric unit, and they were dealing with young children with eating disorders, and you're surrounded by all these people who also have eating disorders. What was that like?
It was kind of, it became a place for us to teach each other kind of how to stay sick. And you know, you just get stuck in a room with people that are also really underweight, and you start to compare yourself to them, and you know, it just kind of like keeps the illness in motion, I think.
What were meal times like?
They were nuts. Like, we all sat around a table with a nurse, and like we're just trying to hide food like in every way possible. People were like spitting it down their sleeve, like throwing raisins across the room like when the nurse wasn't looking. Like you learn some interesting tricks when you're trying to like avoid eating that much.
So even a raisin was like, that was calories, like, that you didn't want.
It was every calorie was like, seemed like such a big deal to me back then.
What were the nurses like?
They were all lovely. Like, I don't remember disliking any of them. Yeah, it was really interesting. Like, we had to, they had to wake us up, I think it was like at six every morning to, they'd supervise us like peeing, and then they'd weigh us, and they'd shower us because we weren't allowed to shower ourselves in case we exercised or passed out. So it was really like, there was no privacy at all, which I suppose is fair.
You think that's fair?
Considering, like, the stuff we got up to when, like, we tried to get away with everything we could, I suppose. It was like, it felt like, for me, that I would lose my life if I didn't lose weight. And there were, like, around me, like, a bunch of people forcing me to gain weight. Like, it was terrifying.
Talking about also this weighing, like, that's pretty confronting for someone, I imagine, with an eating disorder. Did you think about that at the time, or was it just sort of made sense?
Yeah. I got pretty used to it. And then, because I had to enter some eating disorder treatment when I was maybe 18 as well. And I think I always hated that about the treatment, that they made it all about weight when, like, we all had these really deep psychological issues that were never really touched on.
So you weren't receiving any sort of psychological help or therapy, things like that?
Not when I was in the children's ward. It was completely about medical and weight restoration. And then later on, when I was in the other psych ward for eating disorders, there were support groups and stuff in there, but the focus was really on restoring weight and eating.
Just to like nail down sort of your timeline, so you're about 14, 13, and you get sent to these places. How long would you stay there?
I might have been there maybe 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And then I'd be discharged, and then, really quickly I'd stop eating when I was at home, and, I'd lose the weight, and then they'd readmit me, because I had to go into this clinic thing where they, when I was outpatient, and they'd weigh me to make sure that I wasn't losing weight, and every time I went there, they were like, you've lost weight, and we need to readmit you.
Did they seem surprised that you'd lost weight?
No, like, I think that's a cycle that they see so often, is that no one can, maintain the same level of, like, nutrition or eating that they did when they were in hospital. I think that the pattern was that people generally deteriorated straight after their admissions because of the lack of support.
When you say lack of support, like, what would you have pictured or wanted?
Look, like, I still don't know the answer, and but I think if there was someone who could have psychologically supported me to get through that stuff, that would have been great. And I think it was just like, in that case for me, I just didn't happen to have a psychologist at the time, so it was kind of just my parents trying to make me eat all the time, and no one to help me through it.
Did you have people in your life, would anyone comment on your eating? Were they ever just like, just eat? Like, why don't you just do it?
Yeah, like, you kind of get used to that stuff because there's such misunderstanding about the illness still present. Like, people just don't really get it.
So you went to the child hospital wing, and you were there for 2 to 3 week stints during the school year, I assume. And then how many times did you go there?
I think it was around 5 times.
5 times. And over how many years?
That was all in 1 year.
1 year, 5 times. So you must have been out of school quite a bit.
Yeah, so I was. And then, so I think that was during year 10 that I had all those hospitalizations, and then When I went into year 11, I had to miss a whole chunk of school because I needed a parent to supervise me pretty much around the clock so that I didn't self-harm or, you know, vomit up my meals, and they had to supervise me eating. So I stayed home for a big part of year 11, and I pretty much taught myself all the content of school.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I had nothing else to do. Like, I had to stay at home. I wasn't allowed to go out walking or anything.
No walking?
No, like, no form of exercise at all.
Was exercise, like, something that you would obsess about?
It wasn't my biggest kind of obsession, but, like, I did it when I could get away with it, I suppose.
Was there anything at that time in your life that you just did that was just, like, for fun? Or was just always about...
No, like, I kind of lost everything. Like, the illness just completely consumed me. And there was, like, I had no other thought content than the kind of stuff related to my eating and my body image.
And so you became 18. You're 18. And then you said things started getting a bit more intense. You started getting... the next place that you went, they had therapists and things.
Yeah, so when I, like, finally was weight restored when I was 15 or 16, I made this weird decision that I couldn't be underweight until I was 18, because I was resistant to treatment, and every time I was resistant to treatment, my parents, they had the legal capacity to be able to put me in that treatment, so I thought I'll just weight restore until I'm 18. And then, like, I'll finally lose the weight I want to lose. So when I was 18, I had this massive relapse thinking that no one could stop me. And, yeah, I think I got down to about, like, 30 kilos. And, like, I was just passing out all the time. Like, I would fall over and hit my head. And, like, every time I stood up and... I was still treatment resistant, so my parents started to kind of threaten me with, like, legal guardianship, like taking me to court so they could make my medical decisions for me. So I just ended up agreeing to be admitted to a hospital that specialized in eating disorders. And I think the first time I was there, I only stayed about 2 weeks before I discharged myself. And because it was just horrible. It was, like, a really traumatic place to be. There were, like, 20 other girls who were just as sick as me. And we had a lot of time to socialize and kind of talk about that stuff. And, I just, like, learnt more ways to be sick and stay sick.
Thanks for listening. And we're going to take a short break and be right back with more This Australian Life. Hi, we're back and you're listening to This Australian Life. As we continue to hear from Elle, from where she left off. When you entered this hospital, is that what you thought it was going to be like?
Yeah, I suppose so. I guess it was quite similar to where I'd been when I was younger, except there was less medical components and more psychological. I guess I kind of expected it to be the way it was.
Were you excited going in? Do you remember that?
I wasn't excited, but I remember feeling relieved that I didn't have to starve myself for a little while. Because I had no choice in whether I ate or not when I was in hospital. I found it really relieving that I didn't have to make that decision. But it was like when I got out, that decision was mine again, and it was really, like, overpowering. Like, I just had to stop eating again.
Did you think ever when you stopped eating in the back of your mind, oh, I'll just go to treatment again after this?
Yeah, it was always, like, the backup. Like, I kind of just wanted... my disease wanted me to just, like, starve myself until I died, really. But I knew that the hospital was always there if things got bad enough, and that was always an option.
Did you make friends with anyone in these places?
I didn't at that time. I was like really quiet at that time, like more quiet than I am now. Like I just didn't talk to anyone. I didn't talk to my family. Like no one could get a word out of me. I was just like so consumed by my thinking.
If you met you now, like what would you think if you saw you?
I don't know. I think it would break my heart. Like I see photos of myself, like how I used to be, and it really like terrifies me because I was so, so ill and it didn't register in my mind at the time. Like I was just like deathly thin and I seriously thought that I was overweight.
Do you think talking would have helped? Do you think anything could have helped you?
I'm not sure. Like, I think the willingness has to kind of come from within, and I didn't have it at the time. I saw a documentary recently where there was this hospital who kind of, they allowed the person with the eating disorder to make a decision whether they wanted to, like, try to recover or whether they wanted help living with their illness for that time. And I honestly think that's a really, like, great thing because I was forced into a recovery that brought on really, like, severe depression because I was so resistant to that recovery and people were forcing me to gain weight. And it was, like, I felt like my body had been violated and I had no choice in it. And, you know, I think I would have been ready at some point. So, yeah, I'm not sure.
So you talked a little bit about drug and alcohol use and how maybe that might have been something that continued from the eating disorder. Mm. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So after that really severe relapse of my anorexia, like after a period of time, I developed binge eating disorder. Like my body just started to fight back and I was just like at home all day, every day eating and I had no control over that and I couldn't stop it. And that became really, really traumatic. So I think like my kind of response was to just like shut out all of that pain. And I found that, you know, I could do that through alcohol or drugs. And if I ever wanted to just switch off, like I could, yeah, like smoke a bunch of weed or drink all my mom's wine and I could just go to sleep and forget about it for a while. And then, yeah, it just ended up that I had to start doing that every day because I so desperately wanted to be like away from that pain.
Do you feel like there's any connection between like you not having a voice, not speaking, and then also having like maybe your autonomy taken away? Like you said, you felt like you'd been violated in these situations. Did you feel like there was any connection to that?
Yeah, probably. But I also think that I stayed that quiet because I felt that no one was going to listen to me anyway. And there were times when I would just break down and I would scream and I'd try and tell people what was going on for me. And, you know, still the only thing they wanted at that time was for me to eat. Like, I just get told, you know, you're really underweight and you're going to die if you don't have this sandwich. Like, and I just wanted someone to kind of acknowledge how I felt, and that never really happened. So I just decided kind of that it was best for me to not talk about it, because when I did talk about it, I kind of just was rejected.
Going now to like drugs and alcohol as a means of, did you find yourself, were you more vocal when you were using those things, or were you just as quiet?
When I drank, yeah, I was like almost extroverted, which I kind of love. Like it turned me into a completely different person. And I was really like free from all those fears I had. Yeah. And it just like allowed me to feel comfortable in the world. Like, especially when I was at a bar or at a party, yeah, I feel now that I was definitely drinking to kind of access that place of like not feeling threatened or like in fear.
So as your drinking progressed, what happened? Yeah.
So I think the binge eating kind of stopped and it just became drinking most days. Like, and I was probably 19, like almost 20 at this point. And, I'd already lost my job because I couldn't show up because I was either terrified of, the way my body looked or I was drunk. Or I showed up on ecstasy. And so I didn't have a job anymore, and all my friends were at uni or working, and I'd kind of wait around at home and I'd be messaging them just asking like if they wanted to come get drinks with me after they finished. And there was never enough people to kind of accommodate me for that. Like, no one wanted to drink as much as I did. So I guess I kind of just ended up like drinking at home alone most days. I was just a mess. Like, I was also using, like, I was smoking a lot of weed. And I went to Revolver a lot. And the way I kind of took drugs when I went out was, I would take them like I was drinking. Like, I'd just keep taking more. And pretty much every time I took pills, I ended up overdosing. And there were multiple times where in clubs, like, I completely stopped breathing and turned blue. And, a lot of my friends were there to witness that stuff happening. And, so I went through a period where I tried not to take pills, but I ended up smoking a lot more weed. And, I started to develop these, like, voices that I was hearing. And they were really strange, like, it was because I live near a train station, and every time a train went past my house, I'd hear these voices telling me things about, you know, the way my body looked, or what I should be eating, or, if I should kill myself, like just these kind of command voices. So I had to, like, I realized it was coming from the amount of weed I was smoking, and I'd been smoking synthetic weed too. So I tried to cut that out, and I just ended up drinking so much more. Like, I just couldn't function without something in my system. So, yeah, I think, like, when I was 20, I was just blacked out, like, a lot of the time, and a lot of, like, really horrific stuff happened to me during those blackouts because I had no self-control, and a lot of horrible things I think can happen to women when they're in that state of inebriation. So it kind of created this like trauma that I didn't know how to deal with, and I had to keep drinking to deal with that.
You're here today, so there is an end.
Yeah. So that year when I was 20, I started entering general psych wards again. I was seeing a doctor who, he didn't really acknowledge my addictions. But he would put me in the general psych ward to detox me and then keep me in there for kind of, therapy, I guess, and just to keep me safe. And I was in there, I think I was in there 5 times within the year. Each of them, maybe, I think the admissions were like a month and a half long each.
So you were in there a year, and each time it was a month and a half. So do you mean like a year, like total, like spread out over a series of years?
So I wasn't in there the whole year. It was 6-week admissions in the year.
And so it's almost like lines up pretty closely to that time when you were 14, and it was those, like, what, 2 to 3 week stints also.
Yeah, I found that every time I started going back in there, I kind of got trapped in the system again. And it was just like I was like stuck in a loop of being in there and then being discharged and then becoming really unwell and then having to go back in.
Was there ever an option where you're like, no, I'm not going back in this time?
Yeah, like that was kind of my preference, but like I suppose I was just so unwell that the people around me, they didn't want me to be out. But I think everyone kind of knew that I wasn't getting the help I needed in there as well. I think I was mainly in there so that I wouldn't do anything to seriously harm myself.
What was it like in these places?
Like, I suppose the hospital I was in, it was quite a big psych hospital and there were a lot of patients in there. And it was like a weird community. Like, everyone kind of became friends and, like, it could be really toxic at times. Like, people would go off and kind of, like, fuck themselves up together. And it was just that whole thing of, like, staying sick together type thing.
Thanks for listening. We're going to take a short break and be right back. Hi, this is Kate again, and you're listening to This Australian Life.
And I made a lot of friends in there who turned out to be really, like, no good for me. And I suppose there's, like, also, there wasn't much, I don't know what the word is, facilitation of what was happening between patients. Like, I suppose in the hospital, like, I know a lot of stuff went down that was never dealt with by the hospital, and probably will never be dealt with, and they turn a blind eye to that stuff.
Do you want to give an example of some of the things that happened?
So I was assaulted in, like, the psych ward. I chose to not speak about it, but I know other people who the same thing happened to, and they spoke about it, and, like, it just was never really acknowledged.
So the people who spoke about it, they would say something to the nurse, and then the nurse would what?
You know, I assume they'd file an incident report or something, but, like, I don't really know where that information went, because there was nothing done about it. And, yeah.
And that person, the person who assaulted them, they were allowed to stay in the hospital?
Yeah, I think most times they were.
So they had to, like, eat meals with this person and see them?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and I know this happened to at least 4 people that I met in there. Mostly females being assaulted by men who were in there for treatment.
So at the same time, you're seeing this sort of very toxic behavior happening between people. You also talked about friendships and things like that. Like, how did those pan out?
For me, like, I met a lot of people in there that had the same kind of drug problems and addictions as me. And when we were discharged, like, often we went out drinking together. And it just got so messy. Like, those nights kind of often ended with, like, I don't know, someone had tried to commit suicide or someone had ended up back in hospital. It was, like, really, really intense.
So before you came into this hospital, had you found, like, a community, like, sort of you were finding in these places?
Yeah, like, because I had no friends, like, in the real world at that point. Like, I thought it was kind of a good thing at the time that I was making all these friends in hospital, but, like, it just didn't turn out so well. And a lot of them, you know, still haven't recovered like I have. And it's really sad, like, because I choose not to be around people who are really ill anymore because it brings out kind of my own defects and my own illness.
Did you ever talk about, say, with your parents, what it was like at these places?
Yeah, I did. Probably not. I probably didn't tell them the actual extent of what was going on. I probably touched on it, but not enough to worry them. I think I was sick of worrying everyone and being like a pain.
Now, do you think it would have been a pain to tell them that?
Yeah, definitely.
You still think it would have been a pain?
Yeah. Like, I still think that, you know, particularly my family, they, or anyone, like, I don't think people know how to deal with this stuff. So I constantly feel like I'm being a pain because, yeah, because no one really is taught about this stuff. Yeah.
Was there ever a time when you're like, you know what, like, mom, dad, or whomever, like, I'm ready to change. This is like different. You're smiling as you.
Not until after rehab or during rehab, but I think like in those in-between times before I went into rehab, I made those kind of promises to myself. Like I'd say, or I'd, yeah, kind of think like, all right, it's time to change. I'm going to do it this time. But I wouldn't tell anyone because I didn't want to be accountable for it if I couldn't do it. And like most times I couldn't do it on my own. Actually, every time.
You spent a significant time in these places. What happened after that?
So I was deteriorating so much over that year, and I finally got to a point where, you know, the alcohol wasn't working for me as a solution anymore. And I went on this massive bender where I blended a bunch of like Valium into my wine, just trying to reach that state of like inebriation that I could get to previously. And I couldn't really get there, but I would, like, went into this insane blackout, and I came to on my front porch just like sitting in my own blood, and I called myself an ambulance, and I was just, I kind of made that decision at that point that I really needed to get help. And I went to this emergency department, and I kind of just begged them to put me in a rehab because I knew that was my problem. And I got into that rehab, and that was where it started to kind of get better. Yeah.
So previously you'd been in a, and it was more psych focused.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there was no focus on addiction really.
And this one made a difference. It was different for you.
Yeah. Like I don't think the actual rehab program did much for me at that point. But it was where I was introduced to a 12-step fellowship, that kind of changed everything for me. Like I was, I think, 10 days into that rehab, and I went out on leave and I bought a bottle of wine or something, and I got a box of Valium and I took it into the rehab, and I just got like messed up for a whole day and no one noticed.
No one noticed that you're on Valium and drinking?
No. Like I was blacked out for a whole day of rehab program, and I don't know how I did it, but no one brought it up.
Do you know anybody else who would be in the rehab and using?
Yeah, like most of the patients in there were still using. And like they tried to kind of stop that stuff from happening, but like the efforts really weren't that great, I suppose.
How did the other patients still use?
I remember there was a dude in there still shooting heroin in his room. I don't know how he got away with that, but and there were people that were bringing ice in and selling it to the patients. yeah, and then like I know other people had their family go out and get alcohol and bring that in when they were visiting. Like there's a lot of dodgy stuff going on.
So their own family brought in alcohol. But why were they in these rehabs?
Like I know some people were in there for court reasons. I don't think anyone that was in there had made the decision for themselves to be in there, really. Like I think that most people were forced into it. But I tried like day programs where you'd go in and do a group therapy session every day, and like that didn't work for me either. I don't really know the success rates of it at all, but like I'd just go to that therapy session and then get booze on the way home. Yeah.
So at this point, you're dealing with this 12-step program, and you leave the rehab after, what, 38 days?
Yeah, yeah.
And what happened from there?
From there, I kind of just, like, immersed myself in that program, and I got well really quickly. I think I did drink again after 40 days of being out of rehab. And but that was, I haven't had a drink since then. And like I've made a really profound recovery from there. And you know, I don't think that a person like me is able to moderate my drinking. Like I don't think it's ever going to be safe for me to drink or take drugs just because of the way I do it and the way kind of my brain is wired, because I just want more of everything when I have it. So like I've made the personal decision to just stay sober and clean, and that works for me and my recovery.
In the second half of our show, we're hearing from Elle's father, Bruce. Bruce is an established independent businessman born and raised in Melbourne. At first, Bruce had no idea of the extent of his daughter's struggles. I would never have guessed the path through addiction and finally healing she would walk down. Today, Bruce shares with us what it's like to watch someone you love, a child, struggle with something you can't even understand until it happens to you.
There was a moment in time, and I remember it very well, and it was around just before she developed her eating disorder, or before we discovered it. And I remember saying to someone that they asked me, oh, how are the kids going? And I'm going, well, you know, the two eldest ones are a bit all over the place, but Elle has got it nailed. She has absolutely got her shit together.
Thanks for listening. We're going to take a short break and be right back. Hi, this is Kate, and you're listening to This Australian Life as we continue now with Elle's father, Bruce, and his story. Thanks for listening.
We shared custody of the kids. And they were staying with us they'd been with us one Saturday night, and we'd always walk up Sunday morning to have a coffee up the street, and Elle was in front of us. And I remember saying flippantly, gee, you're looking a bit light, mate. You need to eat a bit more. And the more that we looked, the more we started to panic. And this is the case. And that was the start of a journey that went on for 5 years. So within a week of that, I'd quickly got on to Elle's mum and going, are you noticing something? And she said, yeah, yes. From that Sunday when we were walking up the street, walking behind her, it was a week later she was hospitalised. And then we went through a period of time, I think over a 10-week period. She was in hospital for 7 weeks. So this 10-week period played out with us at home. When she was at home for the 3 weeks within the 10, we'd be trying to force feed her. It got to a point, we know it would get to a point where she wouldn't eat for 24 hours, or she'd just take in water or whatever. That was the trigger point for us to take her back to hospital. But to get her back was incredibly, or almost violent. It was incredibly physical. We'd have to pick the right car. Our car didn't have, it was a little two-seater, a mini, and we didn't have We couldn't get her in easily, so I'd borrow my dad's car. It had child locks on the back. Either her mum or my wife would sit in the back, and we'd physically lift her in, kicking and screaming, and you'd have to push her in, quickly get the seatbelt on. Whoever was in the back seat would have to restrain her, close the door, put the child locks on, head off to hospital. And we get to the other end, and I'd park right outside of the emergency ward. I'd run around. Whoever was in the back would still be holding Elle. I'd quickly open the door, I'd grapple her, and I'd literally carry her in, often almost breaking her limbs because she'd be kicking and screaming and punching and scratching and whatever. Then we'd get into emergency, and so my wife or my ex would go over and register her, and I would literally hold her on my lap. This is a 16-year-old girl, in a bear hug, so that she couldn't move until the nurses came out. The way that 10 weeks transpired was they would force feed her, so she'd be in an eating disorder ward, and it would there'd be four girls in a ward, and they would just force food into them, and they weren't allowed to do anything. They weren't allowed to walk. They'd go around in a wheelchair all the time, and they'd get assessed, and if they got to a certain weight and they were on a certain menu, they'd leave. So after this went on for about 6 weeks, so across that 10 weeks. The final week, they decided that they weren't getting anywhere. I think we'd taken her home, and she just went back to her old habits. And so they said, look, we've got one other way that we can deal here. And it was feeding her through the nose, so nasogastric food. So if she wouldn't eat at home, we'd take her into the car. We'd take her in the car, kicking and screaming, to emergency. Two nurses had come out. They'd hold her down. They'd put a tube up her nose, and they'd feed her nasally. And then she'd settle down. We might get that. Obviously, try to feed her solid foods first, but she'd always say no. And then we'd get to take her home again. And next meal, same day, if she didn't eat again, we'd take her back out. So it was kind of 30 minutes each way. So this went on for a week, that we were taking her out several times a day, and she was getting fed through the nose. By the end of the week, she'd broken. We'd broken her, and she was starting to eat. And so we took her home at the end of that week, but it was still there. The illness was still there, and she thought that because she started eating that she could drop her meal plan from a very high-calorie meal plan down to a lower one. So this is the eating disorder still trying to rule the day. Our therapist said, no, you've got to stay on the high plan. So that night she took an overdose ended up in a adolescent mental health unit at that hospital. Scary, incredibly scary. When we took her there, they put her in a courtyard. I remember it well. There was no one in there other than a 17-year-old boy who was really mentally disturbed, and his testosterone was going through the roof. So here's this petite little 16-year-old in this open courtyard with this 17-year-old who's growing hair off everything. And the first thing he says is, I want to marry you. Someone said to us, you do not want to stay here too long. If you're here 3 days, it's 2 days too long. Get out of here. And that was one of the nurses. And so we did, and she came home, and I'll move forward now, because she kind of recovered, and we'd lost the first term of year 11. She went back to school. I think we'd convinced her, we all felt convinced that she was on the mend, and she got right through year 12 and did exceptionally well. She did a lot of creative subjects and topped the class in many of them. Came out of there and turned 18 and relapsed. And matter of fact, she started relapsing through year 12, but we just didn't know it. And the relapse was profound on a number of levels. The biggest one was that we no longer had legal control over her because she'd become an adult. And so whereas before we could take control and apply the FBT and force her to go to hospital and whatnot, now we couldn't. And so that elongated the journey. And so it went on for another year or two, and she got down to an incredibly low weight. I think at her worst she was about 32 kilo, and she was tripping in and out of hospitals. In across 5 or 6 years, I think she spent 3 Christmases in hospital, in different clinics or hospitals. And I must go back just one moment in time. In all of this, the scariest moment that we've ever had was actually not. It didn't eventuate the case, but in one of the visits that she came home from her initial trip to hospital, she was at her mum's place, and she was in the front room, and it was close to the front door, and we'd already studied up on this, and we knew that doing a runner was a real possibility, because she'd just come home from hospital that day. I got a call, one of the kids rang up and said, "Elle's gone." I'm going, "What do you mean she's gone? She's done a runner." I thought, you know, she's gone, as in not with us anymore. She's done a run. Oh, my God. Okay. So it was just on dusk. So we scramble out, and we lived right on a railway line then. We scramble out. I'm running down the street. The kids are running towards me. I'm going to my son, "You go that way. You look on bridges," whatever. I said to my middle daughter, "Call the cops." My ex is out there. We're all running. I'm going, "We're right on a level crossing." I go, "I know what she's doing. This is it." So, excuse me, I walked, I have really vivid memories of this. I could hear a train coming. So I ran down and stood in front of the train. I put my arms up. And this, the train driver hangs out the window and he goes, "What the fuck are you doing?" Literally stopped the train, and my son's looking on, and I go, "I'm sorry, I have a potentially suicidal daughter." Yeah. He was really good. He went, "All right, I'll put it across the network, we'll slow all the trains down." And by then the cops had been notified, and we had the SWAT team, you know, all these guys in the really heavy uniforms, and you know, the guns and the grenades and whatever, they just lobbed up with me stopping the train. It was a surreal moment, you know. And and then we kind of knew, because it was dark, we knew that we couldn't do anything, because she could be hiding behind a bush. There was a lot of territory there that we could not, we wouldn't be able to find her. And so it was kind of an exercise in futility, and we just started thinking, well, that's it. Now it's just a waiting game, you know. She'll do what she's going to do when she needs to do it. So we all sort of tried to fill in a bit of time, but we end up back at Max's place, and the next thing, the door opens. Elle walks in. "Oh, hi." She'd been for a run to lose weight. She wasn't thinking anything. She was just still in her eating disorder. "How can I lose weight? I've just had dinner. How can I lose weight? How can I lose weight?" So it showed. That was the scariest moment, and yet, you know, in reality, the most benign out of anything that went before or after, like her overdose attempt, was much more serious than that. You know, she took 30 something pills, and was lucky she didn't wreck her organs. So move forward, we got over that, and she got better, and then she went through and relapsed, and that relapse actually triggered not only her eating disorder but moved her into substance abuse. And so we were trying to treat her eating disorder. She was going in and out of clinic, the underlying mental disability, the mental challenge, was still there, and we hadn't been able to deal with it. We went through any number of therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists. We just couldn't nail it down. So substance abuse, and it started with drugs, with all different sorts of drugs. Nothing really desperately dangerous, like ice or heroin, but she was certainly taking pills that she shouldn't have been taking. And I actually remember she bought, or she got some drugs from a nightclub the same week as two or three people had died from that dose of pills that were around in town that week.
Here's a short word from our sponsors. Hi, this is Kate, and you're listening to This Australian Life on Joy 94.9.
So she was taking all sorts of risks. She was starting to self-harm quite a bit. And then it tripped into very quickly into alcohol, and that was her substance of choice. So that then played out over the subsequent year, where she would be drunk most of the time and taking really risky experiences, doing risky things. There wasn't much that didn't happen to her in that 12 months, as far as all sorts of different abuses and from other people or from herself. She got lost so many times. So many times she would land home. She didn't know how she got home. She wouldn't have any keys or wallet. We'd track back and we'd eventually find someone in a nightclub that had picked something up and kept it all. But, you know, my ex was constantly changing the locks because she was losing keys and whatever. And she would be drinking from first thing in the morning, maybe 9 or 10 o'clock. It was horrible. The police were involved in some of the stuff, and it was still mixed in a little bit with her eating disorder as well. So she was in and out of clinic, trying to, you know, she'd go into detox, and or she'd go in. They wouldn't know where to put her, you know, eating disorder, detox, whatever. It kind of culminated, this is a couple of years ago now, but it culminated towards the end of that year, and I remember it vividly, that she was getting to a point where, you know, on a daily basis, we didn't know that she would get to the end of the day. We were acutely aware that we would get a call at any moment, and it would be the one that you didn't want. On this particular day, I'd had a meeting in at Fed Square, actually, in Melbourne, and I was just about to jump on the train back to our inner suburban house, and someone said, "Oh, that particular train station is closed. There's been someone hit." Before that, Ella had been calling me incessantly while I was in a meeting, and I hadn't responded, and I thought, I'll run back, jump on the train, and go and see her. I started putting two and two together. But the fact that she'd been calling me was important. It means that she wasn't the victim. And I rang, and she picked up the phone, and she was just desperately in tears. And I said, "Have you just been to the train station?" And she said, "Yes, how did you know?" I said, "Oh, sorry. What happened?" She said, "A young kid dropped their phone, went down to pick it up and got run over, and I was the only witness." Now, she was drunk. She was the only witness because everyone else ran away, and she was too slow. So shortly after, she started pleading with her various therapists, particularly her psychiatrist, you need to put me back into hospital. I can't cope with the real world." And he was really slow to react, just frustratingly so. And so she did probably the biggest self-harm that she'd done. She really carved herself up, and her sister was around when that was happening and found her, and she ended up in emergency ward at one of the hospitals. That was enough for her then to be taken into the clinic, of which she did, and she was convinced that she needed to get better.
Thank you so much. This has been great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, pleasure, Kate. Great talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening today, and I hope you've enjoyed This Australian Life. Tune in next week when we'll speak with Duncan Parvinian and his life as a yoga teacher, teaching the likes of Meghan Markle, and also his life as a scientist, a dancer, and much, much more. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.